Okay, thank you for that kind introduction. And it's an honor for us to be here and talk to you guys today. We're going to talk about something that we kind of really believe in, which is kind of about tropical conservation and what we do. And so what I'll do is I'll kind of basically take you through the introduction. We're going to talk about terrestrial conservation to start with, and I'm going to do that part. Then Lorraine will talk about aquatic conservation. And then what we're going to do is we're going to tell you a little bit about what students at McGill have done in terms of contributing to conservation in Africa, or at least a little bit about what they've done. So tropical forests can look like this. This is a rainforest that we've been working in for over 20 years. So this is Kibale National Park in Uganda. Or all too often, it can look like this. And it's estimated that something like tropical countries are losing something like 12.5 million hectares of forest annually. And this image kind of tells it quite nicely. You know, there's a park on one side, which you can clearly see the trees, and agricultural land on the other side. And I don't know about you, but I can think of what a hectare is. A hectare is about the size of a football field. 12.5 million hectares is way too abstract for me to be able to grasp. You can put it in the size of states. So it's just less than the size of the state of Florida. That's something you can kind of think about. It's not so impressive to put things inside comparisons to provinces, because Canada is a big country. But if you took Quebec, and basically every decade, about half the area of Quebec would be deforested. So it's a lot of forest going quite quickly. Well, I always think about primates, and this area would have supported 32 million primates. So we're talking about basically causing the death of 32 million primates every year. And that is not kind of the whole of it. It doesn't include the amount of forest that's actually logged. So you have basically big tropical trees like this that are getting logged quite rapidly in many areas of the world. And when you think about it, you often think about kind of big industrialized logging that happens throughout kind of the tropics. But also there's kind of small-scale logging, which is very kind of popular where we work, which is basically people like this taking home fuel wood to basically for the stove at home to cook the meals. And it's estimated that about something like 6 million hectares of tropical forest is logged each year. And that's about the size of Ireland. Also, it doesn't take into account fire. And you've probably often heard about kind of people talking about health concerns in Indonesia because of basically the smoke in the air. They often don't really tell you where that smoke comes from, but that's basically the tropical forests that are being burned, often after they've been logged. These things often come in a sequence. And if about 3 million hectares burns each year, then the amount of forest that's either deforested, logged, or burned is about 21 million hectares. The state of Florida is 14 million hectares. And if that wasn't bad enough, there's what's basically what we kind of commonly call the bushmeat trade. And you can see in the back of this pickup, there's a number of primates, number of rodents, pangolins. So this is basically kind of the catch after kind of probably about a week's hunting. And they basically will take any sorts of animals. So this is a chimpanzee that was brought into a village. The next picture is rather gruesome. If you don't like these pictures, just turn your head for the next one. This is how they're commonly sold. Basically, they just smoke them and sell them as smoked meat. And a lot of the hunting is done either by shotgun or by snares. Where we work, it's mostly by snares. And the snares are very effective. The animal walks along, steps in the snare, and basically pulls the animal off its feet. And they're hoping to get small ungulates. So basically small ungulates that stand about this sort of height. But they also get other sorts of animals. So this is a chimpanzee in our community that we work on. And it's basically lost his hand, because he had a snare around it. So basically he was strong enough to pull the snare away from the tree, but he ended up having a wire basically wrapped around his arm, and it kind of slowly but surely kind of basically rotted off because of the infections. It's hard to know how extensive kind of this bushmeat trade is, because as you can imagine, it's a lot of it's local consumption, so it's hard to really measure how big it is. But a colleague of mine estimated for the Amazon, and he suspects about 4 million primates are consumed annually in the Amazon. And I put up the market value of this, which is $42 million, because if you wanted to stop the bushmeat trade, you'd have to provide alternative sources of food, and that's what you'd basically be looking at. So that's the typical doom-gloom scenario. And I'm actually, or Loren and I are really, in some sense, quite positive that we can kind of make a change and things can be different in the future. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to kind of show you the other side of the scenario. We all know about the doom-gloom scenario, but let's kind of talk about different sorts of perspectives. So I'm going to talk a little bit about, you know, what we can do in our research. Loren will talk about her research, and then we'll talk about what students at McGill do. And hopefully you'll see that we can actually kind of make a difference and change things, either through research or education. So I'm going to talk about primate abundance, and then I'll talk about diseases. So we can basically provide the science. So we can provide the information that can be used in conservation. So what I've been interested in for a number of years now is simply the simple question of what determines the abundance of monkeys. And we're looking at this monkey, which is the black and white colobus. This monkey is a red colobus, and he has a collar on him. So we darted him and captured him to evaluate his health and put a collar on him. And this is the red-tailed monkey. So we're looking at all three of those species in particular. And this is Africa, Uganda, and Kibale National Park, which is kind of in the west, just over the mountains, the Rwenzori Mountains, is Congo. And what this slide represents is simply the relative abundance of each of the species at these different locations. And I'll kind of come back to this in a minute. So for red tails, what we did is we went to each of those locations, figured out their abundance, watched them for about 1,000 hours and to find out what they ate, and then asked the simple question, is their abundance determined by the quantity of food that's in the area? This bottom axis is cumulative DBH. DBH is diameter at breast height, so cumulative size, if you like, of food trees. And as you can see, this is their biomass. There's a fairly nice relationship. So when there's more food, there's more monkeys. That makes sense, and kind of logically, now we can kind of use that sort of information. With the colobus, what we did is we did the same thing. And so this is, again, cumulative amount of food. This is their biomass. And everything works perfectly if you just ignore that one little spot. And this is the Dura River site, which is a beautiful, pristine site, which has a river running through it. It's very diverse, but there's simply very few monkeys there. And we initially thought, well, maybe we should just throw out that data point because maybe a disease went through, or maybe that they were hunting, or potentially there was something else that happened. But it kind of bothered us to throw out that point when we only have 7 data points. So we started to look into it a little bit more carefully. And we started to consider not just the quantity of food, but the quality of food. And colobus monkeys are quite specialized in their diet, actually. They can eat leaf material, so they basically eat leaves of tropical trees. And their stomach is basically an alkaline stomach designed to break down leaves. So they break down the structural carbohydrates, so the fiber in those leaves. And that's where they get a lot of energy. And so what we did is we went back to those 4 of those sites initially, and we looked at the quality of their food. So early on, a researcher had said protein was kind of a limiting element, and fiber got in the way of the animals getting that element. So fiber is just, you know, adding bulk to your diet. So this is cumulative colobus biomass, and this is the protein-to-fiber ratio of their available foods. So protein's the good stuff. Fiber is the stuff that basically gets in the way. And what happens is now you get a fairly nice relationship. And so what it appears like is the Dura River has lots of food, but it's a very low quality. So it's the quality at that site that determines their abundance. Well, no manager in the right mind would believe us. We tried to convince them with 4 points. So we kind of extended the data set, and this is the relationship. And we can explain about 82% of the variation the colobus biomass by this index of quality of foods. So we can do things with this information. So about in the kind of mid-80s, kind of through to the early 90s, the southern third of Kibale, so this area, was degraded, and about 140 square kilometers was deforested. This is at the time, basically, you know, when Idi Amin and his follower were in power, and basically the park services, and at that time the forestry services, couldn't really control all the areas. So there's no one in there to protect it. In 1993, Kibale became a national park. It had previously been a forest reserve. and they evicted the people that were in the south of the park. Well, we can use the information from my study to basically tell what you should be reforesting that with if you want to encourage the colobus populations. The red colobus is an endangered species, and the only viable population left in the world is found in Kibali. So the only population more than about 1,000. We can also use this sort of information in carbon offset projects. So we plant it, get paid for the carbon that's stored in those trees, and so we can actually reforest it in kind of a very popular way. Or you could basically use that information to tell loggers which trees they should take and which trees they should leave. You leave the ones that have high protein and fiber leaves. The skeptics in the audience should be saying, well, you never tell a logger what to take, and you're probably right. So they wouldn't do that, but they might be willing to selectively fell away from the trees that are very good for these sorts of monkeys. Because 50% of the trees that die in any logging operation are just simply trees that are pulled over or knocked over when the bigger trees fall. So you could basically have them fell the tree in a set direction. Okay, let's talk about diseases. So yeah, I'm interested in what determines their abundance. So food was one thing, and diseases is another. And we've all kind of, in this day and age, with swine flu, things like SARS, with the devastating impact that AIDS have on human cultures, and with Ebola, basically we're often thinking about what's the effect of diseases on populations. One thing you probably all heard of Ebola and how kind of devastating it can be to small communities. It also basically affects the apes, so chimpanzees and gorillas in the kind of Africa. And Ebola is basically predicted to have caused a decline in 89% of chimpanzee populations and 56% of gorilla populations. And in one national park, they estimated that 95% of the chimpanzee population literally was wiped out in a single year because of Ebola. So we're interested in kind of the potential of working with diseases and how they get transmitted between species. So I don't know about you, but it seems like what people are doing are basically making the situation whereby diseases can be relatively easily transmitted. So things like feeding primates when you get into close contact, or this is mangabey, having a situation whereby you shoot and have bushmeat trade, but then you're butchering these animals and basically have the possibility of basically having a cut in your hand and mixing blood. So we're creating all sorts of situations where disease can be transmitted. And this is a study that really looks at the kind of transmission rates between the two colobus species I've talked about so far and humans. And the idea of this system is it's a model system. You know, I must admit I like my life too much to be studying Ebola. So I studied something that was much safer, and that's basically something called E. coli. You've all probably heard about it. E. coli is in all of us. If it's at low levels, it's fine. It's in all primates and even all birds and mammals. But when you get E. coli isolated, so basically no transmission, over time they become genetically distinct. And so each population or each species will have a slightly different kind of signature of what their Ebola looks or what their E. coli looks like genetically. And this is simply like a family tree. This is basically a genetics tree. And each of these are colored different colors. Red colobus are red. Black and white colobus are supposed to be black and white. Humans are supposed to be gray. And what you can see, all I want you to take home from this, is there's a mixture of colors, which suggests that there have been frequently transmitted E. coli between the different species. We can now use this system to predict under what circumstances that transmission actually occurs. And then it's over to Lorraine.
But he'll be back later. Well, the extraordinary diversity of the African rainforest is paralleled by an equally impressive diversity in their aquatic faunas. However, these faunas, like their terrestrial counterparts, are under siege. So what we'd now like to do is to take you from the forests to the fishes and to the fresh waters that they inhabit, and to talk a little bit about aquatic conservation issues in the inland waters of Africa, focusing on environmental stressors and how they affect the diversity of fishes, and how they affect patterns of biodiversity loss and recovery in the Lake Victoria Basin of East Africa. So fresh waters are among the most seriously threatened ecosystems on the planet, and this is because of many things, but in part because of the tremendous human impacts that they have experienced over the last century. In Africa, the situation is also critical. In Africa, fish catches have declined dramatically. Forests are being cleared, as Colin said, at an extraordinary rate, and this leads to sedimentation into the waters that they once protected. Pollution of groundwater and surface water is becoming an ever-increasing threat to many African waters, and the introduction of invasive or non-indigenous or introduced species is having unprecedented effects on some aquatic systems in Africa. So in my lab, what we do, or we're trying to do, is to address problems of environmental stressors on aquatic organisms and adaptations of fishes to extreme environments like that dry ephemeral pool in the tropics that you see on your right. In particular, we explore the consequences of low oxygen or hypoxia on fishes, but we also look at other environmental stressors like deforestation and the consequent sedimentation that it yields and the turbidity of the water that it produces and the invasion of non-native species. And today what I'd like to do is to focus on hypoxia in particular, but also to look at how it interacts with non-native species in one particular system in Africa. So why hypoxia, you might ask? Why should I be interested? And after seeing all those wonderful monkeys, I might say that too. But let me convince you that it is interesting and important these days. In particular, hypoxia or oxygen scarcity is widespread in natural systems that are characterized by low light and low levels of mixing, like these dense tropical swamps or this flooded forest in the Amazon. Perhaps more importantly, though, hypoxic waters are becoming more widespread as the influx of wastes and fertilizers accelerates eutrophication and pollution. And what we mean by eutrophication is that we're increasing the rate of supply of organics into an ecosystem. We're sort of over-fertilizing our lakes and rivers, and this can have incredible problems. What can it do? Well, eutrophication can lead to thick blooms of algae. Algal blooms, we've all, I think, heard about this in the province of Quebec in the summer, and sometimes those algal blooms are associated with toxins. The microorganisms that take advantage of this rich supply of algae use up the oxygen. This can lead to increasing levels of hypoxia or a decline in the availability of oxygen. What can this do? Well, this can lead to things like population declines and even massive fish kills in some situations. So hypoxia is now recognized as an global issue, an environmental issue of global importance to both fresh and coastal waters. And just to show you that it's more relevant than the parts of Africa that we'll talk about today, this is a picture of the Gulf of Mexico, a cartoon of the Gulf of Mexico showing this is experienced massive eutrophication over the past decades to the point where the waters are sometimes referred to as Gulf of Mexico's dead zone. The red is the coastal waters, and the light colors here, here, and here are where the oxygen is zero at the bottom. And so you can imagine that this has had massive consequences on the communities of those systems. So it's become increasingly important that we try to understand the consequences of low oxygen stress for fish populations and other aquatic organisms. For the past 20 years, like Colin, I've focused my research on East Africa, where oxygen scarcity is widespread in many systems and problems of aquatic biodiversity conservation are acute. The work takes place within Kibale National Park, which is where Colin showed you, but also in other areas of Uganda outside of protected forests. Well, I started my African adventures 20 years ago slugging through dense African swamps, papyrus swamps like you see here. And this is the most dominant of the emergent wetland plants in East and Central Africa. A sixth of Uganda is covered with swamp, and so it is a habitat of great ecological importance. And it's not well studied. The logistics are a bit challenging sometimes, and so we don't still understand a lot of the dynamics of these systems. But they are fascinating. For me, they're fascinating because they're extremely hypoxic. These are some of the most extreme environments in the world for fishes to have to deal with, but they're packed full of fish. Like many of the early explorers in East Africa, the first thing that we noticed about the dense interior of papyrus swamps is that there are air-breathing fishes, like the African lungfish here or this clarion catfish here. So not all fishes breathe water with their gills. There's a few fishes like the lungfish and the catfish that have air-breathing organs, and they go up to the surface and take a bubble of atmospheric air to meet their oxygen requirements. The lungfish has a primitive lung-like structure. This clarion catfish has a little air-breathing organ in the back of its head, and it also walks over land quite well, using these fins here as struts. And it does that mostly in the evening and during rainy periods. So you can imagine that for these guys, low oxygen stress is not much of a problem, and they do quite well in swamps. But of the 24,000 fishes that we estimate to be around the world today, only 2% of them can breathe air like these guys. And so air breathing is not a likely strategy that we're going to see as a response to increasing levels of global hypoxia. Fishes are going to have to do something different. So what else do we find in those dense African swamps? Surprisingly, we found several non-air breathing fishes that persist under extreme hypoxia. So these are your basic fish that breathe with their gills. And they have a real challenge in low oxygen waters. Water, even when it's saturated with oxygen, is hard to breathe. It's so dense that it holds 1/30th the amount of oxygen that's in the air. So these guys are dealing with a much more severe situation than that. Now, one of the most fascinating discoveries that we found was this little species, Pseudocrenolabrus multicolor, or old blue lips as we fondly refer to it for obvious reasons. I'll just call it P. multicolor today. And it persists in these extreme environments. It's really interesting because it's a haplochromine cichlid fish. And there are hundreds of haplochromine cichlids in East Africa. But many of them are very stenotypic. And what we mean by that is they are very selective in their habitat. They're found in one habitat, in one lake. But this species, P. multicolor, is very widespread, and it's found in many different habitats. It's what we call a maternal mouth brooding fish. And all of the haplochromine cichlids that are in East Africa are mouth brooders. And what this means is that the mom, here's mom, she, when the eggs are laid, she picks them up in her mouth, and they're either fertilized just before they enter her mouth or after by the male, and then she holds them there. Talk about being a nice mom. She takes care of them for, in this species, 23, 24 days. She can't eat, obviously. She circulates them around. They hatch in her mouth. These little guys, they're down here. These guys have hatched. And then she lets them out of her mouth after about 3 to 4 weeks. And you can see they're well-developed fish at this point, and they can feed on their own. They hang around mom for a while. If some predator comes by, then she'll vacuum them up and protect them and then spit them out again. And eventually they'll disperse. So as I said, P. multicolor is a special fish for us because it's found in a wide variety of habitats, from this hypoxic swamp to this well-oxygenated lake to this fast-flowing river where it must contend with high water current. So how does it do this? How does it survive in all these habitats that are so different? To address this question, the first thing that we did is start to compare P. multicolor from different habitats that we collected when we collected fish in Uganda. And just as an example, we found a lot of differences between swamp-dwelling fish and fish from high-oxygen sites. And this is one example. This is a figure that shows the relationship between the gill size in the fish and its body mass. And obviously, bigger fish are going to have bigger gills. But what I want you to notice is that for a fish of a given body mass, the swamp fish have much larger gills than the same species that's found nearby in a well-oxygenated site. We found all kinds of other differences as well. So this is good for the swamp fish because the larger gills will increase their ability to take up oxygen. But why would you want to be in a swamp anyway? Well, one of the things that we've discovered over the years is that the dense interior of dense African swamps is characterized by a low number of predatory fishes. So it may be a good place to be in terms of avoiding predation. But there's got to be a cost to those big gills. I mean, if there wasn't a cost, why not just always have big gills? Why not have them here, here, and here? Why make them small over here? So we were interested in trying to think about the potential costs of the proliferation of the gills and how that might contribute to keeping these populations separate in the field. Now, one of the things we looked at on these same fish was the size of their brains. And what we found was this is the size of the brain and this is the size of the fish. And what I want you to see is that for a fish of a given body mass, the swampers have smaller brains than their conspecifics, that is, the members of their own species that are from a nearby open water site. There's several reasons why this might be the case, but one is that the brain has a very high oxygen demand, so it may be difficult to keep a large brain in a hypoxic environment for the fish. This is one approach. We're studying the consequences of this in the next couple of years. The next thing we did is we took fish from Africa, from these different populations, and we brought them back, and we reared them in the lab under low or high oxygen conditions. So when the mom released the young from her mouth, we would split them into two, so we had all brothers and sisters, and raise them under these different conditions until they matured. And again, what we found was that fish reared under low oxygen conditions had larger gills. They had larger heads to accommodate those gills. They had smaller brain mass. And they had a faster embryo development, among other things. So a whole suite of strategies that they could invoke if they were reared under their hypoxic environment. And this means that they have a high level of developmental plasticity, that their morphology and their physiology is determined in part, not completely, but in part, by the environment in which they're reared. This sort of plasticity that we see in this fish might actually be a very useful strategy in a changing environment in the face of global hypoxia increasing or other anthropogenic factors that are affecting fish biodiversity, such as the introduction of non-native species. So now what I'd like to do with that background of hypoxia in mind is link it to how it interacts with another very serious concern throughout the world, also in Africa, the introduction of non-native or invasive species. And we're going to look at the interaction of these stressors and their impact on biodiversity loss and recovery in the Lake Victoria Basin of East Africa. Lake Victoria here is the largest tropical lake in the world, with its water shared by three countries, Uganda, Kenya, and Tanzania. Dark orange means high population density, so you can see that around the lake there's a lot of people. It is thought that this lake affects the lives of about 30 million people. Lake Victoria is also Africa's largest inland fishery. It's the source of the Nile River. It's the common ground that binds East Africa into a natural geopolitical unit. But for scientists, Lake Victoria also harbors an evolutionary treasure. Until recently, there were about 500 endemic species of these wonderful, colorful cichlids. These species had evolved in that system and were found nowhere else. Unfortunately, there's been a mass extinction of this fauna, and we'll talk a little bit about that. Lake Victoria, over the last century, has undergone massive fundamental changes in its ecology. And I'll just tell you a little bit about what's happened. First, fishing intensified over the century with the successive introduction of new technologies, boat motors and gill nets and things like that. So by the 1950s and 60s, there was alarming evidence that in a lake the size of Switzerland, many of the stock fishes, the native stock fishes, had been overexploited. And fisheries were collapsing. So new species were introduced to try to compensate for depleting commercial fisheries. And this had a major influence on faunal composition and balance. Now, the most infamous introduction was that of the Nile perch, Lady's niloticus. It's a large centropomid predator. It's related to snook, if any of you fish down south on the East Coast. And this species was introduced into Lake Victoria in the 1950s and 60s. The idea was to convert those small, colorful haplochromine cichlids into a large exportable food product and to boost the sport fishing industry that was developing at the time. Did it do that? Yes. The Nile perch laid low until about the 1980s, and then it underwent this phenomenal upsurge. This created a very important industry for the three countries that share the waters of Lake Victoria, an export market to the tune of $200 million US a year, and that's just the export market. That doesn't include the local markets as well. So the people around the lake would like the Nile perch to remain a sustainable fishery for economic reasons. But the upsurge of Nile perch also coincided with an ecological catastrophe. When the Nile perch went up in the 1980s, the haplochromines that had already been overfished continued to go down, and the upsurge of the Nile perch coincided with the demise of about 40% of these fishes. Now, other problems in Lake Victoria, like eutrophication that we talked about earlier, certainly contributed to the final collapse of these cichlids, but the Nile perch has been a key player. And what's interesting is that similar changes have occurred with the introduction of Nile perch into other lakes of the Lake Victoria Basin, including Lake Chioga. This is the Victoria Nile, the Nile River, and it becomes this large Lake Chioga area, which is an extremely important fishery. Nile perch were also put in there. They were put into some small lakes around here, and they were put into Lake Nabagabo here that we'll focus on in a minute. So we have replication of an economically lucrative but an ecologically devastating phenomenon. But the news is not all bad. Of course, some fishes did persist. They persisted in the face of eutrophication. They persisted in Lake Victoria in the face of Nile perch and in the face of pollutants and other things that are happening to that system. And knowing what allows them to persist is really important to the conservation of this remnant fauna. So we spent some time when we started working on Lake Victoria, several years, looking for habitat refugia, habitats where native fishes might be protected from predation by Nile perch or other anthropogenic stressors. And what we found was that wetlands tend to be very important hypoxic refuges from Nile perch predation. We did our wetland refugia work a little bit on Lake Victoria, but mostly on Lake Nabagabo, this lake here. So this is Lake Victoria, and it would go like out the front door of the building. And this is the satellite lake, Lake Nabagabo. It was cut off about 5,000 years ago by this sandbar. It's surrounded by this enormous Luamunda swamp that's riddled with passageways and lagoons and is extremely hypoxic. But what's neat about the system is that Nile perch were put into here just after they were put into here. So it's a good little model system for trying to understand and predict patterns in this much more complicated Lake Victoria. When the Fisheries Institute of Uganda went back to Lake Nabagabo after Uganda's period of civil war, we didn't have any sampling during that time, but after, in the early 1990s, they found that the native fish fauna had undergone a faunal collapse, just like in Lake Victoria. The Nile perch had become the most important food fish, as well as another introduced tilapia, and 50% of the native species could no longer be found in the main lake. But the status of that enormous wetland around the lake was unknown. So for several years, we made expeditions to Lake Nabagabo to try to evaluate the role of hypoxic, low-oxygen swamps as faunal refugia, as habitats that might protect fishes from Nile perch predation. And we looked at two kinds of wetlands, the wetland ecotone, where the wetland comes out and meets the open water, and this should be quite accessible to fishes. And then we went way, way, way into that dense swamp around the lake to a series of small swamp lagoons. And these are extremely hypoxic. The wetland ecotones are modestly hypoxic. This value here, if this water were saturated with oxygen, if it were doing good, it would be about 8 milligrams per liter. So this is somehow hypoxic, and this is extremely hypoxic. What did we find when we went into these swamps over the years? Well, over 50% of the species missing from the open waters of the main lake were found in these wetland refugia. So that was good news. More species were found in those edgy wetlands than way deep in the dense swamp interior, and that's probably because the extreme conditions of the swamp limit colonization and survival. Now, we did find some Nile perch in the ecotonal wetlands, but none were recovered beyond the margins of the fringing swamp in that dense swamp interior. And at that time, we hypothesized that this was because the Nile perch is wimpy and it can't handle low oxygen very well. So to test that, we used a set of physiological studies on the Nile perch, and we did find that Nile perch are very sensitive to low oxygen conditions and that they may be physiologically excluded from wetlands. So these wetlands are important because they can serve as nursery areas, as habitats that might protect fishes from Nile perch predation, but only those species that can handle the hypoxia. Our wetland refugia work, along with that of others, has led to policy changes in the region, which has made us happy, including a change in the status of that enormous wetland surrounding Lake Nabugabo, which is now a wetland of international importance. So now perch do show low tolerance to hypoxic stress, and we believe that this low tolerance has played an important role in minimizing interaction with some native fishes that can handle these conditions in the swamp. Why is this important? Well, it's important because these remnant populations of species that have persisted with the Nile perch and in the face of eutrophication have provided the seeds of resurgence. Over the past decade or so, the Nile perch fishery is very lucrative, and it has been intensively fished to the point where it's been overfished, or people might suggest it has. And this has coincided with a resurgence of some species into the main lake, in Lakes Chioga and Navigabo in Victoria. So there's been a resurgence of some fishes, particularly cichlids, in these lakes. So that's exciting, but one must note that the resurgence of the cichlids is really only a few species and a few trophic groups, a few different kinds of feeding groups. But the biomass is really coming back, and that's exciting to us. In Lake Nabugabo, that small lake where we've been working for the past 16 years, we've been able to follow the pattern of collapse and resurgence of the fishes in a little bit more detail. And we have found that the numbers of Nile perch have decreased in the open waters associated with heavy fishing pressure. We've also found that the mean size of the Nile perch has gone down between 1995 and 2005. And this is because we think the fishermen are selecting the larger fish and they're sort of fishing down the populations. This is good news for the cichlids, maybe not so good news for the fishery, because continued pressure like that can select for a small growing, smaller Nile perch, and that's not what the fishery wants. So the future of the haplochromine cichlids and the other native species in Lake Victoria is really difficult to predict. It's because the Nile perch is a moving target. It goes up and down, and its predators, the fishermen, determine its dynamics. But we do know that some of them are coming back. We know that extinction was the unfortunate road taken by many. But we know that some of these ones are remaining. But the question is, have they changed? Why would they change? Does anybody think of any reason why they might change before and after the Nile perch? What kind of changes might you think would happen? Lack of oxygen. So what would the fish, what could happen over time if the fish adapted to the low oxygen? The fish change, gills change, gills could change. What did you say back there? Nice and loud. You can turn on your mic, it's a little red button. Or just yell, actually. What'd you say? Their brain size could be getting smaller. There's all kinds of things that could be going on. Thank you. Very good. So we started to look at these things. Now, it's a little hard because we can't go back to 1960 or 1950 and fish, right? So what we've had to do is to go back to archive specimens. And unfortunately, the Lake Victoria Basin, and this is the problem with many of the lakes in developing countries or developing areas of the world, the data are sparse. And for a lake the size of Lake Victoria, that's hard to believe, but data are sparse. Anyway, one of the things we've done is we've looked at body shape. And the reason we've done this is that You've already made some suggestions about what might happen over time when a fish is under such selection pressure. It's experiencing generations of low oxygen, generations of environmental change, generations of predation pressure. Well, one thing it could happen is it could alter its body shape to become faster or less easy to bite or something of that nature. And so we looked at this. And there's three haplochromite cichlids that are now resurging in Lake Nabugabo and that are also represented in the British Museum of Natural History from the collection that was done by a little Cambridge expedition of undergraduates that went there in the 1960s. And they have provided the only data that we have on these species at this time. Anyway, what we did is we went to the British Museum and we photographed these cichlids on grids. And then we went to Lake Nabugabo in 2005 and we collected some of the same species. And then we put what we call landmarks on them to quantify body shape using a set of tools called geometric morphometrics. But basically what you do is you find places that you could always identify on the fish, and you mark them, and then you analyze them for shape changes. And did we find evidence for change? Yes. This is just two of the species, 1964 specimens from 2005. And what we find that shape variation was reflected in a smaller body depth in 2005, a shorter head in 2005, and the pectoral fins, these guys here, had moved forward. Now, what are the performance implications of that? Well, we don't know that yet. We're working on it. But if you look at the swim performance literature, this is consistent with changes that might increase the burst speed of a fish. So we do think that these body shape changes might have ecological relevance. And the third species showed the same kind of change, which is interesting. So our goal now is to look at some of the other things you talked about, like brain size and gill size and things like that. Anyway, the Lake Victoria Basin has a lot to teach us about the impacts of anthropogenic stressors on aquatic systems. And it certainly confirms this growing awareness that humans are significant drivers of biodiversity and that fishing is a strong pressure. But how do we bring the lessons of Lake Victoria to bear on global freshwater crises? And how do we engage our students here and in Africa in being active in finding solutions to not only local but global problems like climate change, like eutrophication, like the transmission of diseases? East Africa seems very distant to many, but technology is rapidly shrinking our geographical barriers. And as the most international of Canadian universities, McGill provides an exceptional environment for students for fostering research and training and capacity building in Africa. In 2004, McGill administratively enveloped the Canadian Field Studies in Africa program. And this is a program where from January to April, approximately 40 students travel to Africa with a staff of professors and teaching assistants and a medical doctor. And they take a term of courses in Africa. And this is a melding of both the natural and social scientists. So it brings a diversity of backgrounds of students together. Well, they obviously experience the wonderful landscapes and the extraordinary biodiversity that we think is characteristic of East Africa, but they also become much more aware of the interlinked nature of environmental health and human health. They interact with the fishers, they interact with the cattle keepers, they interact with the farmers, they interact with the environment, and they work with local scientists that are engaged in research at various places along the way. They travel from Uganda to Kenya, and they end up in Zanzibar, so they experience a wide diversity of habitats and cultures. And they take home with them many messages about the cultures and the science and the environment in Africa, and I think it's a truly life-changing experience for many of the students. Now, graduate training is the same thing. One of the key things that we can do in terms of contributing to research and training in Africa is training of graduate students. And the interaction between graduate students, the synergy between North American and Ugandan students working in North America and Uganda is truly transforming, and I think it really helps with pan-cultural communication. So with that, what I'd like to do is just turn the floor over to Colin for a couple of minutes while he tells you a little bit about another project that we have going in Africa.
Okay, I'd like to tell you a little bit more about kind of one of the things that some of the students that went over to Africa basically did. We kind of helped organize it, but a lot of this is kind of their own doing. So when we were over in Africa, I was studying diseases. We started to think about human health. Benefits of international research and training extend beyond the kind of the boundaries of the particular study. So, you know, we were interacting with people like this. You know, we know they're the father of these children. So we start to really think about kind of human health. And if we wanted to decrease things like setting snares for bushmeat, we have to think about the causes and why those people are setting those snares. This is Joseph Berahunga. He's the kind of village elder, village chief. And this is his family. This is his second wife, and this is the house he lives in. He's a very nice person. I don't know if he hunts. I don't really ever want to ask him. But, you know, what they're mostly hunting for is simply to put meat on the table for their families. So, you know, it's kind of ironic when we drive up in our, you know, four-wheel drive vehicle and say to school kids, you know, don't go hunting. Because, you know, the hunting is really to bring food to the table. So we started thinking about health, and health as a way of kind of encouraging conservation. So life expectancy right now in Uganda is about 45 years old. 26% of the children under the age of 5 are malnourished. This is despite the fact that the soil is very rich and it could easily provide them with what they need. 30% of all the deaths among children ages 2 to 4 are caused by malaria that could be easily treated or prevented by providing bed nets. And there's a lot of waterborne diseases because the place where they bring their cattle down to are basically the place they get their water, their drinking water from. And the average distance to the nearest hospital is about 10 kilometers. And you could imagine they don't have vehicles, what it would be like to basically be having a difficult pregnancy and have to basically get on the back of a bicycle and ride 12 kilometers. We're actually the hospital, the ambulance for the community if someone gets really sick and knock at our doors at 2 o'clock in the morning. We wanted to kind of work with the Ugandan Wildlife Authority. So this is kind of like Uganda's national parks. And they have a very broad kind of statement mission. They want to conserve and sustainably manage the wildlife and protect areas of Uganda in partnerships with the neighboring communities. So it's very broad and very general because they really do try to work with those neighboring communities. So we can kind of use that, their statement, to help us kind of coordinate activities. So we basically formed what we call the Kibale Health and Conservation Center, and it's basically directed at providing health and education for the local community. And this was only made possible, yeah, I've been working on diseases, but I'm not a medical doctor. This is only possible because the doctor who comes along on the Canadian field studies, along with those students, basically said, okay, well, I'll volunteer my time to help set it up and help supervise it. And so he's donated a lot of time to help setting up this clinic. So what we basically did is we made a plan for what the clinic should be, and students in architecture helped. We set up a very simple website. We ran some benefit dinners and other sorts of fundraisers. These were all organized by the students. They had lots of different venues where they tried to raise some money. We started building a relatively small clinic inside the national park. We hired now two nurses. This is Nurse Dennis, the first nurse. And this last year, we got enough money to hire a second nurse, who was a female, Lucy. And as of February, when the students were there this last year, we basically opened the clinic. And the clinic is now running smoothly and efficiently. The number of people coming to it is increasing every month. And this is really something that the students have helped do. We couldn't have done it without their assistance. So, you know, they can make a difference, quite dramatic difference, to the local communities by basically kind of these sorts of activities. This is the opening ceremony. It was quite kind of spectacular. And with that, we'll just kind of say, you know, thanks for listening, and then both of us would be willing to answer any questions.
wonderful talk. I'm a science writer, and I'm very concerned with conservation. And one of the things I've been researching is, it's a long story, but bushmeat is part of the concern. And I'd like you to talk a little bit about why the people, you said the soil's very rich. Are they pastoralists? They don't grow crops, or these are agrarian people. They're not indigenous people, right?
So this cultural group basically got to this area just about over 1,000 years ago. Their small-scale agriculture is their mainstay, but a family typically will have, if they're well off, they'll have a couple of cattle, maybe a pig and some goats. That would be kind of a well-off people. They don't tend to go into the forest all that much in general, except for people who kind of take it on as a career to go poaching.
Even if they're wealthy, do they keep the animals mostly for milk, or they would kill them when they need, like when they're fat enough or whatever? And
basically both.
But you're talking about people who are generally too poor to have enough protein on the hoof like that, so they'll go into the forest out of necessity. But what about like protein-rich plants? There's just not the wherewithal or too many pests? Or?
Well, the population density is about 240 people per square kilometer. So it's really pretty high. If you're poor, the likelihood of getting a cow is probably beyond your means. So it's a readily, easily available source of meat. But you know, one thing we're really concerned with is kind of disease transmission in that setting. So Kibale, fortunately, they don't actually hunt monkeys. Basically, it's taboo. Monkeys look too much like people, which is a great, many ways facilitates our research. But one thing with colleagues and I are doing is really trying to find out what the diseases these monkeys actually carry. So a couple years ago, we darted the red colobus. You saw the one with the tag on. And we looked at kind of what sort of diseases they have. We found basically a new strain of AIDS that had never been described before. We found a number of new viruses of different types that have never been described. So that genetics work is done with the CDC in Atlanta and my colleague in Wisconsin. But yeah, they have some pretty nasty diseases that potentially could be transmitted.
Any other questions or comments? Go ahead in the back. You can turn your little mic on. There's a button there. It goes red. Perfect.
You can hear me?
Perfect.
Okay, I don't know if this is a ridiculous question, but I was thinking about the lack of oxygen in the water, and I'm wondering, is there nothing that's been invented, either a plant that could release oxygen into the water or machinery that could blow air bubbles or something where you can, when you have a lake like that, depleted of oxygen, that you could actually reoxygenate it? Is there nothing?
That's a good question, an excellent question. And it has been, there have been attempts, in particular in the aquaculture industry, to create bubblers that they put at the bottom of ponds and lakes and so on. It would not work on a lake the scale of the size of Lake Victoria, obviously. And there are also a lot of problems with that, because if you're bubbling air near the bottom sediments, you also bring all these nutrients and sediments that have been without oxygen into an oxygenated environment, and they quickly use up the oxygen. So it's not that that hasn't been done, and it is done in some small scale aquaculture facilities and so on. It's just not an answer to a big problem. The main answer to things like eutrophication is really minimizing the nutrient loading to the lake, and that's what we're doing in some lakes in Canada and other areas of the world. And the wetlands are actually really important, because the wetlands take up a lot of nutrients. And the papyrus that you saw is the fastest growing herb in the world. It grows a meter a month. So you've got all this turnover, and it saps up the nutrients, and it is used as a natural biofilter around the Lake Victoria Basin. Until a couple of decades ago, that was successful. Some of the big cities, the main cities, use this biofiltration for their sewage treatment and so on. But these wetlands are actually being overloaded by points, so it's loading into big cities now. That's a good question, though. Any other? I saw one other hand up there. Go ahead.
I would be very interested to know if you looked at the depths of these three lakes that you mentioned, Lake Victoria, the wetlands, and the other lake that was on the eastern or the western side.
Mm-hmm.
Did you look at depths?
Sure.
And what was the influence of those depths, and what are the depths?
Well, the depths, okay, so Lake Victoria is one of the African Great Lakes, but the ones that we often think of are the rift lakes like Malawi and Tanganyika that are shaped like this. Those are the true rift valley lakes. Lake Victoria is a pan that sits in the middle. And so even though it's the size of Switzerland, it only reaches a maximum depth of 80 meters. So it's like a pancake. So it's very volatile. Small changes in water level can produce huge changes in area. And it doesn't operate like a rift valley lake like Tanganyika or Malawi. It's been very susceptible to small changes in climate, to changes in water level, to droughts, to rainfall, because of that very shallow basin. And the wetlands themselves are usually very, very shallow. But the papyrus will actually break off into these huge islands that then float out, or fish will be associated with that. But it starts off as in soft sediments, so it's very shallow. Did that answer your question? Oh, the little Lake Nabagabo, the one that was separated. Oh, that one is shallow. It's about 8 meters in depth. And what's interesting about that lake, and also Chioga, that dendritic one at the top there, is that they haven't undergone the eutrophication that Lake Victoria has. They're incredibly well buffered by wetlands, and yet they've still undergone a faunal collapse. So we do know that eutrophication hasn't driven the entire change in the Lake Victoria system, and the Nile perch has probably been a very important player.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm concerned about the trophic collapse with the cichlids, and I'm wondering what kind of terrestrial species have been impacted by that, like the storks that eat the lungfish or whatever. I mean, what?
That's a great question, actually. There's been some nice studies done on the dynamics of the food webs within the lakes. There hasn't been a lot of work thinking about the implications, but there has been some very cool studies on the pied kingfisher, which has been very much influenced by the change in the food web structure on the lakes. So I guess my answer to that would be there certainly have been impacts, and that they have not been, that terrestrial aquatic linkage has not been as well studied as the within lake. Changes in the food web.
If we go back about 1,000 years, basically the area from the western side of the country all the way across to the east would have been tropical rainforest like Kibale. And in 1,000 years, it's all been deforested. So you would have had, elephants and hippos kind of throughout that area. So it's really been quite a dynamic change, and it's kind of been for the negative in many of the areas.
One of the things we do know from this is a bit divergent, but it relates to your question, that we've been studying inside Kibale Forest and learning about, not because we wanted to, but because we had to, is the impact of the elephants on the papyrus swamp systems. And that's a terrestrial aquatic linkage that these linkages are studied in terms of the dynamics of these engineers like hippo and beaver and elephants and so on. But what the elephants do is they love to come into papyrus swamps and wallow in them, and they create an opening. When you create an opening like that, the oxygen goes up a little bit, and fish production in that area goes up. So the elephants interact with the swamp in a very meaningful and important ecological way inside Kibale National Park. The swamps that are just outside the park don't experience that. And one of the things that we have been planning to do for some time is to compare those. But we've been following the elephant fish interactions with inside the park. There are lots of hippos in protected areas. There are very few outside. The hippos are extremely important because they feed at night in the terrestrial environment, and they bring their nutrients back into the water. And so they have a major, maybe you can speak to that better than I can about the hippos.
Well, basically, inside the national parks, which hippos are still abundant, they basically are they're providing fertilizer into the water, because they basically will go a kilometer away from the water source at night, and then during the day they come back and defecate in the water and basically put lots of nutrients in there.
And you can see the hippo line, like if it's been a good hippo year and the numbers are high, when you drive, there's some of these lakes are partially encompassed inside national parks. And so you can see where the hippo have trampled up, and on a good year they've gone further and further. And there, you know, there's actually some discussion of whether culling is necessary now because the hippo populations inside the protected areas have gotten quite high. But we've had periodic diseases that have brought them down. We still have a couple minutes. Yeah, I think, go ahead, sir. Yeah, and then I'll give it back.
Global climate modeling suggests redistribution of water in lots of places in the world. What do you expect in New York?
Well, what we know about African lakes in general is that they're very volatile, and they have been very subject to massive changes with climate change in the past. So there have been some paleolimnological studies where they core the bottom of the lakes and they look for evidence of how the lakes changed in time. And it has shown that many of the African lakes, particularly the shallow ones, are very sensitive to climate change. In terms of the implications for oxygen, it's problematic as well because as you increase water temperature, if you're a fish, you're cold-blooded, your metabolic rate goes up, and so you're going to use up more oxygen. But at the same time, as water temperature goes up, the water holds less oxygen. So climate change could be quite a problem in the area. And you can speak to the effects on forest change in the area.
Kibale, the region that we're working for the monkey work, has basically undergone dramatic climate change. So climate change, you know, is a kind of global averages that people talk about. But then there's hot spots of change. So our area receives 300 more millimeters of rain than it did in the turn of the century. And it's about 4 degrees hotter than it was 40 years ago. So it's way above kind of global averages. So what we're really interested in what sorts of things are going to happen in the future. So we're really lucky. Someone worked in Kibale from 1970 to 1987, and he's given us all his old raw data. And he has things like he sampled trees in 1972, and we can go back and sample those same trees, and greenhouse experiments would suggest that if you get more CO2 or hotter temperatures, you'd actually change the protein content of your leaves. So we're looking at questions like that. As Loren kind of said earlier, we can't go back in time to sample, but we'll use whatever data that was collected to try to look at issues like climate change.
You had a question at the back. You got your microphone on.
Thank you. You'll have to forgive my ignorance of the research dissemination. I don't know how that works, but I'm wondering, you're in these countries, and are the local governments interested? Do they have access to your research? Are they interested in it? Are they interested in using it to improve or rectify certain deficiencies?
I think that's an excellent question. Do you want me to speak to it first, and then
sure.
You can? Yeah. I think part of working in an international sphere and in a developing country is to recognize that the country is the host and you're the visitor. And in Uganda, people were incredibly welcoming when we first went there in 1990 or 1989. It was 2 years after the rebellion, and so there hadn't been a lot of international visitors. So incredibly welcoming people. And we've been fortunate, because the resources were low at the universities at that time, immediately we were asked to serve as honorary lecturers in their institutions. So over 2 decades, we've built up slowly a rapport with our colleagues there. We work very closely, Colin with the Ugandan Wildlife Authority and myself with the National Fisheries Institute. We found that a key contribution we can make is training of key scientists in the area that will go back and make a difference. And so we've tried really hard to come up with mechanisms to contribute to the PhD level training of people that are in the university or in the Uganda Wildlife Authority and so on. But it doesn't come automatically. And I think when we bring our students over there, we try to explain that that they're becoming engaged in a situation that's taken 20 years to develop. And so it's really easy to interact with the villagers and so on. But the trust takes a long time. And that's one of the advantages of being in one place for a long time. There are other disadvantages, but that's one advantage. Maybe you can talk about the Uganda Wildlife Authority and Arthur.
I think you kind of said most of it. I think the thing is, after a long period of time, it's now that they're kind of turning around and saying, well, can you help us write this grant? We have this question, what should we do? And so they're now kind of turning and asking us the questions, and we can often put students on those questions, Ugandan students. And our past students are now often now in positions of influence, so they can make things happen, which is really kind of nice to see happen. Any more questions? I think there was one over this side.
Actually, you just answered it. It was more political in nature, so thank you for that. And I found it very interesting, and your enthusiasm is really quite infectious. So thank you for...
Come on over, Matt. One last question, I think, and then we'll turn the floor over to our host.
I know that the coastal forests of Kenya are under a lot of pressure from things like development for the tourism industry as well as, you know, local communities. Do you encounter any kind of issues with the industry for tourism or the safari industry? And do you have any thoughts of the pros and cons of that industry?
Sure.
Go ahead.
Okay. Uganda is trying to develop, and part of that development is to encourage tourism. It's trying to do it in an appropriate fashion, and they're interested in kind of doing it as best they can, but they're interested in the money as well. Their big animals are basically they have savanna, but Kenya has kind of better savanna systems, but they have forests, so we help them develop in Kibale a basically chimpanzee tourist site, and of course there's the mountain gorillas, and it's a big tourist draw, and they're developing that quite extensively. One example of kind of the collaboration, when you know people first started talking about swine flu, they basically emailed over and said, should we have the tourists wear masks? And I had a colleague here at McGill who knows the head of the Public Health Agency of Canada, and so she asked him, and he basically gave us a really professional expert answer. So there's lots of collaboration. I don't think tourism is causing much negative effect yet. If they keep developing the gorilla tourism, it might. Unfortunately, though, a lot of that tourism revenue doesn't really stay in the country. Park fees do, and a lot of that park fees money goes back to the local community. They've mandated that 20% of the park fees, which are returned back to the community, as community development situations. So the community decides they want a certain project, a school. They want trenches dug around the national park because they don't like the elephants coming out, those sorts of things. So 20% of the entrance fees to national parks gets turned back to the people.
I think to keep on schedule now, we have to turn the floor back over to our host. Don't we?
One more question. One more.
Is there one more, or are we okay?
I'm just interested to know how much time you actually spend during the academic year in Uganda.
Well, we have to teach here.
You can give for that. We might spend more.
We spend time with the Africa program in January and February, and we return in the summer for research. So at now, only maybe 3 to 3.5 months a year when we first started, and we were younger and postdocs at the time, we were able to spend 8 or 10 months. But we, of course, have responsibilities at both ends.
Thank you very, very much.
Okay, thank you.
It's a wonderful presentation. And I have to say that there was a comment in the back about your passion is infectious, and it truly is. I mean, we're very caught up in that as you're explaining to us your great work. So on behalf of the Alumni Association, just like to give you a little something.
Well, thank you so much.
And thank you very, very, very much. It was very stimulating. And you actually see how far the, McGill's research actually goes. So I thank you all. I believe there's another quaff going on in the building you may be signed up for. We also have the reception that starts around 5:30 downstairs in the main hall. We look forward to seeing you there. And enjoy the rest of the weekend. Thank you.
Thank you very much.